Yeah, he's got to be here. There he is. There he comes.
Now the prisoner wearing a black sweater, he has changed from his t-shirt, is being moved out toward an armored car. Being let out by Captain Fritz. There is the prisoner. You have anything to say in your defense?
What?
There is a shot.
Oswald has been shot.
Oswald has been shot. Oswald has been shot. A shot rang out. Mass confusion here. Holy mackerel. A shot rang out as he was led into his car. The shot was a mass confusion there, rolling and fighting as he was being led out. Now he's being led back. He was thrown to the ground. The police have the entire area blocked off. Everybody stay back is the yell.
That's a radio reporter named Ike Pappas giving an on-the-spot account of the first murder ever broadcast live on American TV and radio. The setting was a parking garage in the basement of Dallas City Hall. The time was 11:21 on the morning of November the 24th, 1963, 2 days after President Kennedy's murder. Oswald was being transferred from City Hall to the county jail, which was 10 blocks away down Main Street. Like so many aspects of Oswald's incarceration so far, his transfer was being done in this public way for the benefit of the press. Ironically enough, the aim of the Dallas Police Department here was to show the world that it was treating its prisoner well and wasn't beating him up behind the scenes. Reporters had been told that Oswald's transfer would take place at 10 o'clock. Some of them had been waiting in the parking garage since 9. But up on the third floor, in the office of the Homicide Bureau Captain J.W. Fritz, Oswald's final interrogation was running long. When Oswald finally appears in the parking garage at 11:21, it will be almost 90 minutes after his scheduled transfer time. He'll be coming down in an elevator from the third floor and leaving the jail office through the basement door. Between that door and the car park, there's a traffic lane with a ramp on either side leading up to the streets above. One ramp comes out on the Main Street side of the building, the other on the Commerce Street side. At the top of the Commerce Street ramp, a large armored truck has been waiting since 11 o'clock. It's too large to fit inside the garage, so the driver has backed it right up to the exit where the ramp meets the sidewalk. The reporters waiting in the basement are under the impression that Oswald will be perp-walked up that ramp, then driven down to the jail in the armored truck. But up in police headquarters, it's been decided that the armored truck will be used as a decoy. It will head up Elm Street empty, and Oswald will be put into an unmarked sedan that will leave the basement via the other exit and drive him to the county jail along Main Street. So if anyone's got plans to hijack the armored truck on its way to the jail, they won't find Oswald inside it. Another advantage of the new plan is that Oswald won't have to spend too much time in the open once he steps out into the garage. Instead of being walked 30 yards up the ramp to the armored truck, he'll only have to walk about 10 steps to the unmarked car, which can wait for him down in the garage right outside the door to the jail office. Up in police headquarters, one detective had argued for a more radical last-minute change of plan. He's in favour of smuggling Oswald out of the building on the ground floor and putting him into a cop car at street level and whisking him off to the jail before anyone in the basement even knows he's gone. But that plan was never going to get past Jesse Curry, the chief of police. Chief Curry has promised the press that they'll be able to broadcast and photograph Oswald's transfer, and he's not about to go back on his word. Anyway, the distance from the jail office door to the unmarked cop car will only be 10 steps or so. What could possibly go wrong? Well, one thing was going wrong even before Oswald stepped out the door. The unmarked car wasn't in place yet. It was still trying to back into position along the traffic lane, but there were too many cops and reporters in the way. On unedited video taken in the basement in the seconds before the shooting, you can hear the driver of the car beeping his horn just out of the picture, trying to get the people behind him to move. But they're all looking the other way, watching the basement door. The activity there seems to have heated up all of a sudden. The first members of Oswald's escort are starting to come out. Then the man himself comes into view. He's wearing dark trousers and a black sweater over a pale collared shirt. His hands are shackled in front of him, and there's a second set of cuffs connecting his right wrist to the left wrist of a big Texan cop beside him who's wearing a pale suit and a white cowboy hat. What happens next looks very rushed and clumsy and matter-of-fact. On paper, it may be a turning point in American history, but on videotape, it looks like a badly staged action scene. A chunky and uncoordinated guy wearing a dark hat and baggy suit lunges forward and jams a revolver into Oswald's belly. There's a single bang, and Oswald lets out a guttural cry of pain and crumples to the ground. Strangely, some people in the picture take a while to realize what's going on. There are people just a few feet away from Oswald who are still looking the other way and don't seem to have heard the shot or the commotion behind them. Some of them are still getting out of the way of the unmarked car, which finally reverses into the picture at almost the exact instant Oswald is shot. A TV anchorman who's watching the live feed but hasn't heard the bang is saying that some sort of scuffle appears to have broken out near Oswald. In fact, the crowd in that area has split into two groups. One of them is gathered around Oswald, who's lying flat on the concrete. He's mortally wounded, and he'll be dead within 2 hours. A few feet away from the dying Oswald, another group of cops is wrestling the gunman to the floor. His name is Jack Ruby. He's a 52-year-old local nightclub owner and man about town. Just after firing his shot, Ruby said something like, "You killed my president, you rat." His gun is a .38 revolver, and he surrenders it immediately without any fuss. He looks up at the cops who've pinned him to the ground, and he says, "I'm Jack Ruby. You all know me." The shooting of Oswald by Jack Ruby is a lot more straightforward than the shooting of Jack Kennedy by Oswald. Ruby committed his crime in full view of the cameras. Around 80 million witnesses saw him do the deed on live TV. So there's no whodunit angle here. With Ruby, the only real question we have to deal with is why. What made him do it? What was the meaning of his crime? This isn't a trivial question. In fact, you could say that the meaning of the whole Kennedy assassination hinges on the answer. To conspiracy theorists, the meaning of Ruby's crime is self-evident. Obviously, he murdered Oswald to silence him before he could divulge the truth about the conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination. The shooting of Oswald is the proof of the plot, as far as the conspiracy theorists are concerned. Indeed, Oswald's on-camera death was the moment that launched American conspiracy theory as a mainstream movement. A lot of people who weren't conspiracy theorists before Ruby shot Oswald became conspiracy theorists at that moment. They'd been prepared to believe that a lone nut had shot Kennedy, but the idea that another lone nut had then shot that lone nut, the idea that American history had been changed by two different lone nuts in the space of 2 days, that was just too much for a lot of people to swallow. And you can't blame people for thinking that way at the time. Oswald had been murdered in police custody with the whole world watching. The idea that the Dallas Police Department could be so fantastically incompetent as to let this happen by accident seems almost inconceivable. It's almost easier to believe that they let it happen deliberately. A poll taken a week after Oswald's death found that just 29% of Americans believed that President Kennedy had been killed by Oswald alone, while 52% believed there must have been some sort of conspiracy. And that figure has consistently stayed above 50% ever since. The shooting of Oswald by Jack Ruby made the idea of a Kennedy conspiracy seem more likely than not, especially if you knew nothing about Ruby. But what if you did know something about Ruby? Does knowing him make the idea of a conspiracy seem more likely or less likely? In this episode of the podcast, we're going to zero in on the character of Jack Ruby. And as we do that, we'll effectively be zeroing in on the whole question of whether there was or wasn't a conspiracy to murder Kennedy. Because if there was a conspiracy in this case, then Jack Ruby was the human face of it. A lot of the time, when you're dealing with the conspiracy theories in this case, it's like playing whack-a-mole. You can squash one possible conspiracy, and another conspiracy will pop up in another place. If you squash the idea of a Dallas conspiracy, you'll be told that the conspiracy was hatched in New Orleans. If you squash the idea of a New Orleans conspiracy, you'll be told that the conspiracy was hatched in Mexico City. If you demonstrate that Oswald was exactly the kind of person who would murder a president alone, the conspiracy theorists will say, "Don't you see, that's what made him such a perfect fall guy." But they can't do that with Ruby. If there was a conspiracy, then Ruby was most definitely involved in it. And whoever the other conspirators were, they had to have had some kind of demonstrable link to Ruby. Ruby is the place where the rubber of the conspiratorial idea meets the road of reality. He's a flesh and blood man that we can grab by the collar and put under the microscope. And if we find out that Ruby had his own reasons for shooting Oswald, then that is pretty much game over for conspiracy theory. I suppose that a die-hard conspiracist might say that even if Ruby was a lone nut who acted for reasons of his own, that doesn't necessarily mean that Oswald was too. Maybe there was a Kennedy conspiracy that didn't involve Ruby. But that would be a desperate claim. It would also be an ironic one, given that it was Ruby's shooting of Oswald that gave early conspiracy theory its biggest break. Arguing for a conspiracy without Ruby is like removing the table from under a house of cards and hoping that the house of cards will stay up. As we get to know Jack Ruby in this episode, we're going to find that he's a paradox. If you don't know much about him, he looks like the single best card in the conspiracy theorist's hand. But on closer inspection, he's a wild card. He's the joker in the pack. And the question we need to answer is whether the joker is high or low. Maybe Ruby is the conspiracy theorist's trump card, or maybe he literally is a joker, a pathetic and half-mad clown that no self-respecting group of conspirators would ever have trusted with the vital assignment of shutting Oswald's mouth, and with the even more important job of keeping his own mouth shut afterwards. For both sides of the argument, Jack Ruby is a put-up or shut-up proposition. So in this episode, we're going to flip the wild card and see what kind of man Jack Ruby really was. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. When I talk to people about the Kennedy assassination, I tend to find that a lot of people are very interested in it, but they don't know all that much about the story's finer points. There's nothing wrong with that attitude. I wouldn't want everybody to be obsessed with the details of this case. In fact, on the whole, the people who are obsessed with this case are well worth avoiding. Unfortunately, though, this is a case where a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. If you've only heard a bit about this case, the bit you've heard is quite likely to have reached you via the noisy efforts of the conspiracy theorists, whose big aim in life is to leave you with a simplistic and distorted sense of what happened in Dallas. This is especially the case when it comes to Jack Ruby. Conspiracy theorists are very happy for you to not know very much about Ruby, other than the fact that he was a shady nightclub owner, possibly with mob connections, who knocked Oswald off while he was in police custody. Conspiracy theorists see the world in terms of two-dimensional types, and they want you to see the world that way too. The type that they imagine Oswald to be is the patsy, for example, and we've already seen how wrong-headed that idea is. And the type they want Jack Ruby to be is the hitman, the cold-blooded assassin who was assigned to shut Oswald's mouth before he could talk. I wouldn't deny that this superficial view of Ruby does seem quite plausible, given the nature and timing of his crime. If he wasn't a hitman, then why the hell else would he have murdered Oswald? Shooting Oswald point-blank in the basement of police headquarters was a suicide mission. Obviously, Ruby had to know that he wasn't going to get away with it. He was going to be apprehended on the spot, and in Texas, murder was a capital crime which was likely to get you sent to the electric chair. So if Ruby wasn't a hitman, you'd think that he must have had some extremely pressing personal motive for killing Oswald. And yet the explanations of his crime that Ruby offered after committing it seem quite weak. He didn't claim to have known Oswald personally. He said that he murdered him out of patriotism. He said that he wanted to punish the, quote, rat who had killed his president. He said that he wanted to spare Jacqueline Kennedy the ordeal of having to return to Dallas to attend Oswald's trial. He also said that he wanted to, quote, show the world that a Jew had guts. Ruby was Jewish, and that fact was central to his self-image, as we're going to see. But if Ruby's stated motives for killing Oswald don't sound all that impressive, we also need to understand that he was acting on the basis of a very big and very wrong assumption. Ruby had half-consciously imagined that shooting the president's assassin would not be considered a crime. He was genuinely surprised when he was charged with murder. He thought that by killing Oswald, he could save everybody else a lot of time and trouble, including the Dallas DA. He assumed that he would be hailed as a hero and a patriot. He never expected to spend a night in jail, said a Dallas attorney who spoke to Ruby in the hours after the shooting. And Ruby wasn't necessarily crazy to think this way. The belief that Ruby hadn't really committed any crime worth speaking of was pretty widespread in Dallas after Oswald's murder.
I think he just did what a lot of other Americans would have liked to have done. And actually, I don't think he had a fair trial altogether.
That's a Dallas citizen speaking soon after Ruby was convicted of Oswald's murder. Here's another one.
I think, like most people do around here, I'm on Ruby's side, and I don't think he should be deserved to be fried.
The view these men were expressing was quite common in Dallas at the time. Newspaper polls taken after Oswald's murder showed that nearly half the residents of Dallas believed Jack Ruby should receive no punishment at all. But the Dallas DA, whose name was Henry Wade, didn't take that view. He was keen to show the world that Dallas wasn't a Wild West town and that the principles of law and order still applied there. Henry Wade is going to be a central figure in this episode of the podcast. And as a point of historical interest, he's the same Henry Wade whose name would be immortalized in the Roe versus Wade case, which was heard by the US Supreme Court in 1970 when a pregnant Texan woman using the name or pseudonym Jane Roe took federal action against D.A. Wade over Dallas's abortion laws. Before Ruby shot Oswald, Henry Wade was gathering evidence to prosecute Oswald for the president's murder, which would have been the biggest trial in American history. Now he had the more pedestrian task of prosecuting Jack Ruby for a murder that had been committed live on TV. Wade charged Ruby with having murdered Oswald with malice aforethought, and he sought the death penalty. Ruby's trial was held in March 1964, 4 months after the murder of Oswald. Ruby's lawyers argued that their client was not guilty by reason of insanity, but the jury didn't buy it. After deliberating for a little over 2 hours, they found Ruby guilty of murder with malice and sentenced him to death. Ruby's lawyers appealed that verdict, and his conviction was finally overturned by the Texas Court of Appeals in October 1966. The judges ruled that Ruby had not been able to receive a fair trial in Dallas. After that verdict, Henry Wade announced that he would retry Ruby somewhere outside Dallas County and would again seek the death penalty. In December 1966, Ruby was in jail waiting for the date of his new trial to be set when he fell ill with what seemed to be pneumonia. Tests showed that his body was riddled with cancer. He was transferred to Parkland Memorial Hospital, the same hospital that both Kennedy and Oswald had died in, and Ruby died there too in January 1967, just a month after being diagnosed with cancer, and a little over 3 years after the seismic events of November 1963. We'll be talking in detail about Ruby's trial later on. We'll also be taking a close look at his movements in the days and hours before Oswald's murder, and we'll be drilling down on the important question of how sane or insane he really was. But before we get into the finer points of his story, we need to know some basic things about Ruby's life. He was born in Chicago in 1911. His parents were Polish Jews who had emigrated to the United States in the early 1900s. Ruby was born Jakob Rubinstein, but legally changed his name to Jack Ruby in 1947 when he was in his mid-30s. Ruby had 9 brothers and sisters, and his childhood was rough. His father was violent, and his mother was a manic depressive who was ultimately confined to a mental hospital. Ruby was in and out of foster homes as a youngster, and he spent a fair bit of time locked up in facilities for juvenile delinquents. He had a lowish IQ and an inflated sense of his own importance. He also had a hot temper, which earned him the nickname Sparky. During World War II, he served in the Air Force. After the war, he returned briefly to Chicago before moving to Dallas in 1947 to help run one of his sister's nightclubs there. By 1963, the year of Kennedy's assassination, Ruby owned 2 Dallas nightclubs. One of them, the Vegas Club, was a legitimate dance club that was managed by Ruby's sister. His other club was a sleazier establishment called the Carousel Club. This was a cabaret club that featured performances by comedians and ventriloquists, along with a permanent staff of strippers. Ruby managed the Carousel Club himself and liked to act as his own bouncer. He had a trusty set of brass knuckles that he put on to make sure that when he bounced the rowdy patrons out of his club, they stayed bounced.
Yes, kind of impulsive. He'd change from one thing to the other at times, do things, you know, out of the clear blue.
You say rather impulsive?
At times.
Could you give us an example of what you would consider some impulsive action?
No, his mind would is always working, always going, and he'd be possibly talking to you about one thing, and then all of a sudden he'd take off about on something else.
That's a comedian who worked at the Carousel Club talking to a reporter in the wake of Oswald's murder and trying his best to describe Ruby's character. The word impulsive is a good start with Ruby, but it is only a start. It doesn't quite capture how dangerously volatile he was.
What kind of a man was Jack Ruby, or is Jack Ruby?
Well, I believe he was a nice employer to me. I believe he's a highly nervous person. I don't really like to give my own opinion of what I really believe.
That's a stripper who worked at the Carousel Club. Her real name was Karen Carlin, and her stage name was Little Lynn. Ruby was a highly nervous person, she says. But the most telling part of what she says there is the last part. The part where she says that she'd rather not say what she really believes about Ruby. The people who knew Jack Ruby did tend to like him, but they also tended to find him more than a little odd. Not just nervous and impulsive, but prone to explosions of incredible violence. When Ruby was beating up the drunks at his club, he could really go to town. Another one of his strippers remembered an incident where Ruby threw a taxi driver down the Carousel Club stairs and then continued to wail on him out on the sidewalk. He knocked him down the stairs and out the door, she said, and when I got downstairs, Jack was beating his head on the sidewalk. Then he stopped all of a sudden and said, "Did I do this?" It stuck in my head, she said, that he could do this and not realize what he had done. One of his friends summed up Jack Ruby's character this way, quote, "It was well known that Jack Ruby was meshuggah, that Jack wasn't playing with a full deck. He was a nice guy, but he just wasn't playing with a full deck. Meshuggah is a Yiddish word that means insane, and to put it bluntly, a lot of the people around Jack Ruby did think that he was quite mad. To get a sense of what made them think that, I'm going to play you a clip of Ruby talking. This comes from one of the many impromptu press conferences that he held during his trial. He's talking here about his religious convictions and about a friend who has been coming to the jail to give him spiritual advice. Beyond that, it's not important to know exactly what Ruby's talking about here. I'm playing this clip to illustrate how he talked.
He lets me believe in the origin of Genesis and all the various starting of the world, and he enlightened me to these various parts of religion that I didn't grasp. Yet people can go on being inseparable in their feelings to their in love to their brother, regardless of what faith they believe in. It was proven to me in my incarceration.
Ruby was on camera when he delivered these rambling, disjointed remarks, and if you look at the film, you'll see that he looks even more troubled than he sounds. He seems to be struggling to get his words out. His whole face looks tight and strained, as if he's on the brink of crying, or as if he's just barely holding it together. Ruby's mother, as I've said, suffered from a serious mental illness and was ultimately committed to a mental hospital. It's hard to know exactly what diagnosis she would have got today, but the diagnosis she received then was that she was paranoid and suffered from senile deterioration, even though she was only 62 years old when that diagnosis was made. Her symptoms included shouting and screaming through the night and doing nothing much during the day except crocheting. She is very noisy and uses obscene language, a social worker wrote at the time. The mother and father fight, the mother making up obscene jingles about the relationship between the father and the daughters. So, the man in the hat who lunged forward to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald in that parking garage was a quirky character, to say the least. He was 52 years old, he was balding, tubby, and vain about his appearance. He regularly popped stimulant pills in an effort to control his weight. He was proudly Jewish in an environment where anti-Semitism was all too common. He was a bachelor, and the evidence suggests that he was probably gay in an environment where it would have been social death to admit that. He wasn't very smart, but his mouth was always open. He had a lot of energy and an unreasonably high opinion of himself. He was erratic, emotional, and violent. And yet he was a hard man to dislike. Everybody who knew Ruby seemed to make a point of saying that, even when they were disparaging his intelligence or talking about his horribly violent temper. And it isn't a trivial point that Ruby was likable, because his likability explains his knack for conning his way into places and situations that he had no right to be in. This knack of Ruby's would come in very handy in the days after Kennedy's assassination, as we're going to see. Certainly, Ruby is a far more likable figure than Lee Harvey Oswald. Ruby was a rogue. He was a character. If he was Australian, we'd have called him a ratbag. If he'd been Irish, he'd have been known as a chancer. Mind you, if Ruby had lived in Australia or Ireland, he wouldn't have walked round everywhere with a loaded pistol in his pocket. In Dallas, on the other hand, that's exactly what Jack Ruby did.
I always carried a gun because of various all occasions I had my gloves. Then I carried a pretty large sum of money at times.
That's Ruby himself saying, I always carried a gun because of various altercations I had in my club, and I carried pretty large sums of money at times. Ruby's habit of walking round armed with a loaded weapon was another key factor behind his assassination of Oswald. If you wanted to be a bit reductive, you could even say it was the key factor. Ruby was a man with a hair-trigger temper who carried a loaded gun in his pocket at nearly all times. When an Australian ratbag loses his temper, there's only a slim chance that the guy in front of him will be dead 5 seconds later. But with Jack Ruby, that was an ever-present possibility. Another one of Ruby's ratbaggy qualities was that he made a big, teary deal out of being a patriot. For the comedians who worked at his club, a couple of topics were strictly off-limits. Ruby didn't allow anti-Semitic or racist jokes, and he didn't allow jokes about President Kennedy. This wasn't because he especially approved of Kennedy's policies. In fact, he had a limited sense of what Kennedy's policies even were, because he had no real interest in politics. But he did have a deep love of his country and a reverence for the office of the presidency. When Kennedy came to Dallas on November the 22nd, though, Ruby didn't have any interest in watching the motorcade go by. For a start, he didn't much like crowds. Also, he had a couple of clubs to run, and he had a regular routine to go through. Every Friday morning, Ruby would go down to the offices of the Dallas Morning News to place the weekend advertisements for both his clubs. But he didn't just place the ads. He actually sat down at a vacant desk and wrote out the ad copy in person. This was a very Ruby thing to do. Ruby loved being a Dallas mover and shaker. One of his acquaintances described him as, quote, a town character, self-seeking and publicity hungry. Another acquaintance said, he was like horse shit all over the place, wherever anything exciting was happening. So that's where Jack Ruby was at 12:30 p.m. on the day of the assassination, when news started coming in that the president had been shot. He was sitting at a desk in the offices of the Dallas Morning News. Other people who were there remembered that Ruby's reaction was typically emotional. He looked dazed and turned very pale. For once, he was speechless. He just stared into space, saying nothing. When he snapped out of it, he immediately announced that he would be closing the Carousel Club that night. By the time he left the newspaper office, he was in tears. Later on that afternoon, he phoned the paper to change the text of his ads. He had decided that both his clubs would be closed for the whole weekend, and he wanted to make sure that this act of patriotism was properly advertised in the paper. Ruby feared that Kennedy's assassination didn't reflect well on the city of Dallas, and since he saw himself as Mr. Dallas, he took the crime personally. At some level, he seemed to feel that the assassination was about him, and that his response to it was a matter of vital public interest. For a while that afternoon, Ruby drove around town checking if other clubs were closed for the night too, and if they weren't, he would trash-talk their owners for failing to show the late president the proper respect. That night, Ruby went to his synagogue to pray for Kennedy. At 10 p.m, he left the service and swung by a late-night deli where he ordered 10 corned beef sandwiches and 10 bottles of soda. Ruby thought that he might take these down to police headquarters and offer them to the cops who were working overtime on Kennedy's murder. Again, this was typical Ruby. The shooting of Kennedy was the biggest event in the history of Dallas, and Ruby was keen to insert himself into the situation. He rang police headquarters from the deli and told them that he was on the way with some refreshments. But the detective who answered the phone told him not to bother. Ruby then decided that he would take the sandwiches down to the offices of the local radio station, KLIF, to see if he could find any takers there. This wasn't a bad fallback, since Ruby liked hobnobbing with journalists almost as much as he liked hobnobbing with cops. But when he arrived at the KLIF office, it was almost 11 p.m. and nobody was answering the door. A lesser man might have given up on the whole sandwich mission at this point, but Ruby decided to head on down to City Hall to see if he could find any KLIF reporters there. If there was one Ruby trait that stands out, said one of his friends, it is that he had to be where the action was. The action that night was at City Hall, and especially at police headquarters on the third floor. That's where Ruby had wanted to take his sandwiches in the first place, and that's where he now turned up. It was shortly after 11 p.m. when Ruby strolled into City Hall. He'd left the sandwiches and sodas out in his car, but he had brought his pistol, which he'd slipped into the right hip pocket of his pants. As he stepped out of the elevator on the third floor, Ruby encountered a cop who was supposedly standing guard there, but somehow Ruby bluffed his way past. Or, as Ruby himself put it later, evidently I took a little domineering part about me, and I was able to be admitted. So that's how good the security was at Dallas Police Headquarters that night. Lee Oswald, the president's accused assassin, was currently in custody on that very floor, being interrogated in the office of J.W. Fritz, the captain of the Homicide Bureau, and Jack Ruby had just walked in off the street, taken the elevator up to the third floor, and strolled on in with a loaded gun in his pocket. He proceeded to mingle with the crowd of reporters who were gathered in the corridor waiting for their next glimpse of Oswald. There's footage taken at police headquarters that night where you can see Ruby loitering on the edge of the crowd. He told anyone who didn't know him already that he was a reporter. He was carrying a notebook, and some people would recall that he flashed them some kind of ID badge. He made himself useful to the out-of-town reporters by telling them who was who in the Dallas Police Department. This guy was Captain Fritz, that guy was Chief Curry, and so on. I felt that I was deputized as a reporter momentarily, you might say, was how Ruby described his memories of that night.
I went down to the homicide division of the Dallas Police, and I guess there were 300 to 400 members of the press.
That's Henry Wade, the DA, who was down at City Hall that night putting together the case against Oswald for the murders of Kennedy and Tippit.
And then, as I was getting out of the place, somebody ran up to me, and he said, "Henry, I'm Jack Ruby." And I said, "What are you doing in here?" And he said, "I represent the Jewish press."
That's how audacious Jack Ruby was. He told the DA himself that he was present at City Hall as a representative of the Jewish press. And it's actually quite possible that in the heat of the moment, Ruby didn't even believe he was lying. "I was carried away by the excitement of history," was how he later described his actions on that night. At one point in the evening, someone even saw Ruby walk right up to the door of Captain Fritz's office and turn the handle and start stepping into the room. But there were two cops guarding the door, and one of them said, "You can't go in there, Jack." So Ruby stepped away, cracked a joke, and went back to mingle with the reporters again. Shortly after midnight, Oswald was brought out of Fritz's office and escorted along the corridor where Ruby was standing. It was a narrow corridor, and Ruby found himself standing just 2 or 3 feet away from the man he would shoot dead in 2 days' time. And yet, Ruby didn't shoot Oswald now, even though his pistol was right there in his pocket. We should ask ourselves why he didn't, especially if we're partial to the idea that he was a hitman who had orders to take Oswald out before he could say anything. If that was Ruby's assignment, then why did he spurn this golden opportunity to carry it out? He was armed, and Oswald was right there, and Ruby had no way of knowing if he would ever get another opportunity even half this good. And yet, for some reason, he failed or declined to shoot Oswald at this moment. Maybe this doesn't conclusively prove that he wasn't a hitman, but it certainly goes a long way towards nixing that idea. It suggests that whatever Ruby's motive was for killing Oswald on Sunday morning, that motive wasn't yet in play on Friday night. It hadn't yet crystallized or become strong enough. The irony of Ruby's encounter with Oswald in the hallway is that Oswald at that very moment was being taken down to his famous midnight press conference in the basement assembly room, the one where he protested his innocence and told reporters that a policeman had hit him, and asked for somebody to come forward and give him legal representation. In other words, straight after Ruby neglected to kill Oswald in the hallway, Oswald was paraded before the cameras and given the biggest chance he would ever have to divulge all the juicy secrets that Ruby supposedly killed him 2 days later to stop him from telling. We're told that Ruby shot Oswald on Sunday morning to close his mouth. But on Friday night, Ruby didn't shoot Oswald, and then Oswald did open his mouth, and nothing of any substance came out of it. Here is an even weirder thing about Oswald's midnight press conference. Jack Ruby was actually present at it. In the hallway, Ruby had overheard the cops talking about where they should take Oswald for his appearance before the press. Ruby heard one of the cops, either Chief Curry or Captain Fritz, say, "Let's go to the assembly room downstairs." So Ruby being Ruby, he thought that he might as well tag along and follow everybody else into the room. "I felt perfectly free walking in there," he said. "No one asked me or anything." Ruby got himself a spot at the back of the room, standing on a table against the wall, and he watched as Oswald answered questions and did his general best to sound innocent.
"I don't know what this is all about.
To summarize this surreal moment in American history, as Oswald said those words, the man who would shoot him dead in less than 36 hours' time was in the same room, standing on a table about 20 feet away, armed with what would become the murder weapon. Had Ruby wanted to, he could very easily have whipped the weapon out then and there and shot Oswald as he was saying those words. But again, he didn't. And again, we're forced to conclude that he just didn't want to yet, and that something must have happened between Friday night and Sunday morning that made him start wanting to.
"Charges have been filed. It will be presented to a grand jury on Reuben immediately."
That's Henry Wade again, the Dallas DA. It's Sunday afternoon, a few hours after Ruby has shot Oswald, and Wade is holding his own impromptu press conference in the assembly room at City Hall. When a reporter asks him if he knows the alleged killer Jack Ruby, or Reuben, as Wade has called him, Wade replies that he doesn't, but he does recall the curious fact that Ruby had been present in this same room 2 nights earlier during the Oswald press conference.
"Did you know Ruby before this?"
"No, sir. Saw him in this very same room Friday night when we had the defendant up here."
While he's at it, Wade recalls another curious fact about that Friday night press conference. After Oswald left the room, Wade himself had stuck around to answer a few questions, and during that part of the press conference, Ruby had actually piped up from the back of the room and participated in proceedings, as Wade recalls here.
"As a matter of fact, if some of you will recall, he asked a question from out here in the audience, or answered a question. He's standing right back here, and I didn't know who he was. I thought he was a member of the press."
"What question did he ask?" "What question did he ask?"
"I don't remember, but he..."
"He answered one, I think.
Maybe it was an answer, but he said something. I think someone here answered that question, in that he answered a question. Somebody asked something, and he answered it back there, and I don't know what it was. I think it is some question about a street or an address or a name or something."
So what was the question that Wade couldn't recall Ruby asking or perhaps answering on Friday night? Well, let's listen to the relevant part of that earlier press conference. First, you'll hear Wade slip up and get the name of the Fair Play for Cuba committee wrong. Then you'll hear a couple of voices speak up to correct him. One of those voices is Jack Ruby's.
"Any organizations that he belongs to that you know of?"
"Well, the only one I mentioned was the Free Cuba Movement or whatever that..."
Fair Play.
"Fair Play for Cuba, I believe was that."
Once again, this was typical Ruby. He'd been listening to the radio reports about Oswald, so he knew what the correct name of the Fair Play for Cuba committee was. And because he knew that, he simply had to speak up from the back of the room and show off his knowledge. What's more, when the press conference was over and Wade had left the room, Ruby couldn't resist going up to him in the corridor and telling him, "Henry, I want you to know that I was the one that corrected you. As Ruby himself admitted later, this was a, quote, childish thing to do. But in many ways, Ruby was childish. He was a big man-child with a limited IQ who just loved to insert himself into situations he didn't really belong in. We need to remember little incidents like this when we're trying to work out why Ruby shot Oswald 2 days later. Ruby liked to be part of things. He liked to matter. On the Friday night, he was able to satisfy that urge by just being present at City Hall and rubbing shoulders with bigwigs like Henry Wade. Ruby's itch to be a part of the story was gloriously scratched that night, and the night wasn't over yet. Having introduced himself to Henry Wade in the corridor, Ruby then took the liberty of introducing Wade to a reporter friend of his who was standing nearby, a radio man named Russ Knight. This was a lucky break for Russ Knight, who proceeded to record an exclusive one-on-one interview with Wade in the corridor. And later that night, when Knight returned to the KLIF studios to broadcast that interview, he made Ruby's night by name-checking him on the air.
I've just returned from the Dallas courthouse on a tip from Jack Ruby, local owner. I had the last interview with District Attorney Wade in the basement of the courthouse.
By that time, Ruby himself was down at the KLIF studios too, and he had finally found some takers there for all those corned beef sandwiches and sodas, which must have been getting pretty tepid by this point. The story of the Kennedy assassination is full of little connections and ironies, and one of them is that one of the reporters who finally ended up eating Ruby's corned beef sandwiches that night was Ike Pappas, the same radio man we heard at the beginning of this episode giving a dramatic real-time account of Ruby's shooting of Oswald. The day after his big night at City Hall, Ruby recounted the story of his adventures there to anyone who would listen. He bragged about correcting Henry Wade in the press conference. He told people how close he'd come to Oswald in the hallway. He said that Oswald was, quote, a good-looking guy who reminded him a bit of Paul Newman. But over the course of that day, Ruby came down off his high, and his excitement was increasingly overshadowed by grief for the dead president and his family.
I was so emotionally upset for 3 days.
That's Ruby recalling his emotional state later on. Ruby's friends and family knew that he was an emotional man, but nobody had ever seen him quite as messed up as he was in those days after the president's shooting. He kept being overcome by weeping fits. He talked about the plight of the widow and her children. He started developing some very strange conspiracy theories about the assassination too. I'll go into those later on, but for the moment, it's enough to say that Ruby's theories about the assassination were so loopy that they made some people wonder if he was officially starting to lose his mind. Upset as he was, though, Ruby was still on the lookout for opportunities to insert himself into the post-assassination action. At one point on Saturday, it was announced that Oswald's transfer from City Hall to the county jail would be taking place at 4 o'clock that afternoon. So Ruby telephoned the offices of KLIF Radio and offered to cover Oswald's jail transfer for them. He explained that he was a good personal friend of Henry Wade, which meant that he could get KLIF a good inside story. Remarkably, the KLIF announcer who answered the phone took Ruby up on his offer. The station was so strapped for manpower that day that it was ready to use Ruby as a makeshift reporter. The previous night, Ruby had felt like he was being deputized as a reporter. Now he actually had been deputized as one. Unfortunately, Oswald's transfer didn't end up happening that afternoon, so we have no way of knowing how Ruby would have covered it for KLIF. We don't know if he'd have shot Oswald that afternoon, or if he'd have been content to just fire a few questions at him. My guess is that Oswald would probably have survived that Saturday afternoon encounter with Ruby. I suspect that Ruby's sense of self-importance would have been satisfied by the fact that he was making his debut as an officially sanctioned reporter. More importantly, I don't believe that he started wanting to shoot Oswald until the next morning. Anyway, the 4 p.m. transfer didn't end up happening because Captain Fritz and his team weren't yet done interrogating Oswald. At around 8 that night, some of the reporters at City Hall were getting hungry and they wanted to go out and get something to eat without missing Oswald's transfer. So they started hassling Chief Curry to give them a definite time. Curry went off to talk with Captain Fritz, who told him that he wasn't likely to be through with Oswald that night. Between the two of them, they worked out what a fair time to tell the press would be. They settled on 10 a.m. the next day. That didn't necessarily mean that Oswald would be transferred at 10 o'clock exactly. It just meant that he wouldn't be transferred before then. As long as reporters were assembled in the parking garage by 10, they'd be guaranteed not to miss anything. Chief Curry went back to the reporters and told them that, and news of Oswald's transfer time immediately went out over the airwaves.
Police Chief Curry has just announced that Oswald will be brought to the county courthouse tomorrow at 10 in the morning. Apparently, this wraps up most of the activity at the city courthouse tonight.
So, by mid-evening on the Saturday, the official word was out that Oswald would be transferred at 10 the next morning, which meant that anyone who had an interest in being there for Oswald's transfer, anyone who wanted to use it as an opportunity to kill him, for example, knew exactly what time to turn up. So guess what time Jack Ruby got out of bed the next morning? The crack of dawn, perhaps? Actually, no. According to his roommate, whose name was George Senator, Ruby got up that morning around 9:30. The fact that Ruby had a male roommate is something I'll come back to. For the moment, I want to stay focused on Ruby's movements on the morning of Oswald's murder. Guess what he did after getting out of bed at 9:30? Did he jump straight into his car and head into downtown Dallas, which was a 15-minute drive away? Again, the answer is no. According to George Senator, Ruby was always slow off the mark in the mornings, and he was certainly slow off the mark that day. He made himself some scrambled eggs and coffee, and he switched on the TV news to get the latest on the assassination. Then he sat round in his underwear, leafing through his morning newspaper, the Dallas Times-Herald. In fact, at the risk of spoiling the tension, I might as well reveal right now that Ruby didn't end up leaving his apartment that morning until a bit before 11. If Oswald's interrogation hadn't run long by more than an hour, Ruby never would have had the chance to shoot him. Looked at from the outside, everything Ruby did that morning seems laughably inconsistent with the idea that he was some kind of professional hitman. Indeed, the evidence suggests that even when he got out of bed that morning, just 2 hours before shooting Oswald, Ruby still didn't have any clear sense of what he was about to do. Really, the fact that he didn't leave his apartment until an hour after Oswald's scheduled transfer time leaves the hitman idea hanging by a thread. If you want to keep that thread intact, you have to believe that Ruby somehow knew in advance that Oswald's transfer wasn't going to happen until almost 90 minutes after the advertised time. But as we continue to look at the way Ruby behaved that morning, we're going to see that the hitman thread is eventually going to snap altogether. It just won't be able to cope with the weight of the countervailing evidence. So if Ruby had no burning urge to kill Oswald when he got out of bed that morning, what happened in the next 2 hours to change his mind? According to Ruby's own story, the critical moment came when he was reading the Dallas Times-Herald that morning. There were two items in the paper that really caught his eye. The first was printed in the letters to the editor section. It was a long open letter addressed to Caroline Kennedy, the murdered president's 5-year-old daughter. This letter is known to assassination buffs as the My Dear Caroline letter. The letter's author was a local Baptist minister named Newman R. McClary, who had taken his two young daughters out of school on the Friday so that they could watch the president's motorcade go by. In his letter, McClary described how Kennedy had looked straight at his two daughters from the limousine and given them a personal wave. "Caroline, it was then I thought of you," wrote McClary. "I thought your daddy must love little girls and boys very much." And McClary went on, "No one can erase this day. You will cry. My children did, my wife did, and I did. You will miss him. We will. You will be lonely for him." And so on. McClary wound up by offering a prayer that little Caroline would be, quote, "cradled in God's love. God will help you. You see, God loves little girls too." McClary's letter sounds awfully overdone when read today, but 2 days after the tragedy of Kennedy's death, his letter caught the shock and grief that a lot of people in Dallas were feeling, and it had a devastating effect on the volatile Jack Ruby. "It was the most heartbreaking letter," Ruby said later. That afternoon, after Ruby had shot Oswald, a press photographer got into Ruby's apartment and took a snapshot of his messy bedroom. In that photograph, you can see a copy of the Dallas Times-Herald dumped at the foot of Ruby's bed. It's still lying open to the double page that had the "My Dear Caroline" letter on it. Over on the next page, there was a second story that caught Ruby's eye. The headline of that story was "State's Biggest Trial Expected," and the story quoted D.A. Wade on the subject of Oswald's prosecution. Wade said that he would try to avoid bringing Kennedy's widow back to Dallas to testify, but he couldn't guarantee that he wouldn't. Ruby said later that this second story was printed, quote, "alongside the Dear Caroline letter on the same sheet of paper." But he wasn't quite right about that. The second story was in fact over the page on the next sheet of paper. But in any case, the juxtaposition of those two stories, the tear-jerking letter to Caroline followed by the revelation that her grieving mother might be forced to return to Dallas to testify at Oswald's trial, lit a fire under Jack Ruby. This was the moment that finally triggered the trigger man. As Ruby put it later, "That caused me to go like I did. I got so carried away." The idea that carried Ruby away was that if he could somehow get to Oswald and kill him, he would be an American hero. He'd be the man who saved the widow Kennedy from the ordeal of having to testify at a trial. "It all happened that Sunday morning," Ruby said. "I don't know what bug got a hold of me. I remember prior to this thought, I was never malicious toward this person." When Ruby said "this person," he meant Oswald. Even after he'd killed him, Ruby superstitiously refused to say Oswald's name out loud. He thought that doing that would be disrespectful to the late president's memory. Of course, just because Ruby said that it all happened that Sunday morning, that doesn't mean we should automatically believe him. Maybe he was lying. Certainly he would lie if he was a hitman involved in a conspiracy. To see how believable his story was, we need to consider how well it meshes with all the other evidence. And straight away we can see that it meshes very well with at least one bothersome fact, namely the fact that Ruby didn't shoot Oswald on Friday night despite having two golden chances to do so. Ruby's actions that night, or rather his lack of action, have always been a big problem for the hitman idea. But his inaction that night is perfectly understandable if you accept Ruby's claim that he just didn't want to kill Oswald until he read Sunday morning's newspaper. Or, as Ruby put it, "prior to this thought, I was never malicious toward this person." Even after the newspaper had planted this seed of malice in Ruby's mind, though, it would still be pushing it to say that he now came up with a firm plan to murder Oswald. It was really more of a vague whim than a plan. He was simply thinking what a lot of other Americans were thinking at the time. Oswald was a smirking little prick, and it would be nice if somebody could permanently wipe the grin off his face. Ruby's homicidal urges probably went no deeper than that at this stage, because he still didn't take any practical steps toward making Oswald's death happen. He certainly didn't rush into Dallas to see if he could still get a crack at him before 10 a.m. We know this because at 10:19 a.m, Ruby was still bumming around his apartment in his underwear when he got a phone call from one of his strippers. It was Little Lynn, the same woman we heard from earlier on. Little Lynn lived in Fort Worth, and she needed some money fast because her rent was due. She was calling to ask Ruby for a loan or advance of $25. Ruby said that was no problem. He said he was heading into Dallas soon and would swing by the Western Union office to wire her the cash. After that phone conversation, Ruby shaved, showered, and got dressed. This took him about half an hour. He was notorious for the length of his ablutions. He takes longer than a woman, was how George Senator described his bathroom routine. And even when Ruby was finally showered and dressed that day, he still didn't leave the apartment. According to Senator, he spent 5 or 10 minutes pacing around the apartment, muttering to himself before he left. He had this look in his eyes which didn't look good, Senator said. After he got dressed, he was pacing the floor from the living room to the bedroom, from the bedroom to the living room, and his lips were going. What he was jabbering, I don't know, but he was really pacing. After all that, it was almost 11 o'clock by the time Ruby left his apartment. As usual, he took his gun. He also took his favourite dachshund along for the ride. The dog's name was Sheba, and Ruby had a peculiarly intense relationship with her. He called her his wife. There were even rumours around Dallas that he had a, quote, abnormal relationship with the dog. And unfortunately, there is some fairly repugnant evidence suggesting that Ruby did have a habit of sexually fiddling with at least one of his other dogs. I'm not going to go into that because it isn't relevant to the shooting of Oswald. But what certainly is relevant is that when Ruby drove into Dallas that morning, he chose to take his favourite dog along in the car. This was a very weird choice if he was about to carry out a contract killing. The fact that he took Sheba in the car gives us yet another reason to believe that Ruby's shooting of Oswald that day was a spontaneous act, and that even as he left his apartment that morning, he still had no serious intention of doing it. It took Ruby around 15 minutes to get to downtown Dallas. As he came to the western side of town, he detoured past Dealey Plaza to look at the wreaths that had been laid there for President Kennedy. Then he headed up Main Street toward the Western Union building. His route took him past the county jail. For some reason, there was a crowd still gathered there, even though Oswald had been due to arrive there more than an hour ago. Ruby found this confusing, and he still sounded a bit confused 6 months later as he tried to describe what had gone through his head at that moment. He said, "And I drove past Main Street, past the county building, and there was a crowd already gathered there, and I guess I thought I knew he was going to be moved at 10 o'clock. I don't know. I listened to the radio, and I passed a crowd, and it looked, I am repeating myself, and I took it for granted he had already been moved." Ruby continued up Main Street toward the Western Union office. Just before getting there, he drove past City Hall, and he saw that there was a crowd gathered there as well, which perhaps suggested that Oswald hadn't been moved yet after all. The Western Union office was on the same block as City Hall and on the same side of the street. Both buildings were on Ruby's right as he drove. City Hall was at the near end of the block, and the Western Union building was up the far end. Across the road from the Western Union, there was a parking lot. When Ruby reached the end of the block, he cracked an illegal left turn across the traffic to get into that lot. I mention this illegal turn because we're getting to the part of this story where every second counts. The most remarkable fact about Jack Ruby's shooting of Oswald is that Ruby arrived at the crime scene only about 5 seconds before pulling the trigger. If Ruby had arrived even 15 seconds later, he would have found Oswald safely ensconced in that unmarked car between two cops. So it does matter that Ruby took that illegal turn into the parking lot on Main Street, because if he hadn't, he would have missed his shot at Oswald. So after parking his car, Ruby crossed the road and walked into the Western Union office. It was approximately 11:10 a.m. Ruby was now 10 minutes shy of shooting Oswald, and he was a block away from the crime scene. His pistol was naturally in his pocket. Sheba the sausage dog was back across the road in the car. Inside the Western Union, Ruby filled out a $25 money order for little Lynn, then waited in line behind a woman who was already being served at the counter. When Ruby himself got up to the counter, the clerk had to add a few bits of missing information to his form and had to correct a few details that Ruby hadn't filled in right. The clerk didn't think that Ruby appeared to be in any kind of hurry. Ruby paid in cash, and the clerk completed the transaction by timestamping his money order. The timestamp said 11:17 a.m. Ruby took his change and his receipt and walked out of the office at what the clerk described as, quote, an ordinary gait. He then turned left on the sidewalk and headed off in the direction of City Hall.
Clerk took my money. After he took the money, I turned away and walked out. I walked down the street, and the curiosity had aroused me because of the flash of my mind, even seeing the people there before I went up to Western Union as I drove by on Main Street.
I've said that we've arrived at the part of the story where every second counts, so it might be worth mentioning here that the Western Union timestamp didn't register the seconds. It only indicated that Ruby had placed his money order at 11:17, so the time could have been anywhere from 11:17 and 0 seconds to 11:17 and 59 seconds. I've also said that Ruby shot Oswald at 11:21 a.m., but since we're talking about the seconds now, it'd be more precise to say that it was only just 11:21 when Ruby shot Oswald. The cop who booked Oswald out of the jail office in the City Hall basement logged the time as 11:20. And when the police dispatcher radioed for an ambulance after Oswald was shot, that call was logged at 11:21, as opposed to 11:22 or 11:23. So when Ruby stepped out the door of the Western Union office, it was 4 minutes at the very most, and maybe more like 3 minutes, until his fatal encounter with Oswald at the other end of the block. In this time, Ruby had to walk 200 paces along Main Street to the top of the ramp that led down into the parking garage, and he somehow had to get past the cop who was guarding that entrance, and then walk down the ramp and work his way to the front of the crowd that was waiting for Oswald's arrival. As it happens, we know that Ruby arrived at the top of the Main Street traffic ramp just under 60 seconds before he shot Oswald. Before I explain how we know that, and before we follow Ruby down that ramp, I want to make one last mention of Sheba the dog, who was still patiently waiting for Ruby back in the car in the parking lot opposite the Western Union. The assistant DA who helped to prosecute Ruby, a guy named Bill Alexander, said later, "People that didn't know Jack will never understand this, but Ruby would never have taken the dog with him and left it in the car if he knew he was going to shoot Oswald and end up in jail. He would have made sure that dog was at home with Senator and was well taken care of." That's an excellent point, although I don't agree with Alexander that you had to know Jack Ruby personally to appreciate it. You only need to have owned a dog yourself, or to have known somebody that's owned one. What that dog in Ruby's car loudly tells us is that even 60 seconds before the shooting, as he approached the top of the Main Street traffic ramp, Ruby still had no conscious intention of doing what he was about to do. Conspiracy theorists have long suspected that Ruby must have had some help getting into the parking garage that day. They think some co-conspirator on the Dallas police force must have knowingly let him in. Ruby's story was that as he approached the top of the Main Street traffic ramp, he saw that the entrance was being guarded by a cop who he didn't recognize. But then a police squad car happened to come up the ramp and out onto Main Street, and the cop guarding the entrance turned around to talk to the driver. Ruby said that he did recognize the driver of the squad car. He said it was a lieutenant named Rio Pierce. or Sam Pierce as he was generally known. According to Ruby, the distraction caused by the exit of Pierce's car allowed him to slip down into the parking garage without being seen.
So I walked towards the ramp. I noticed the police squad car on the head of the ramp, and an officer leaning over talking to him with his back to me. All I did is walk down there, down to the bottom of the ramp, and that's when the opposite happened, at the bottom of the ramp.
Did you recognize anybody when you reached the bottom of the ramp?
No, but I recognized the police officer in the car that was in the car. He was Lieutenant Sam Pierce. And this other man was just talking to him.
Once again, of course, we're not under any obligation to believe Ruby's story just because he told it. But once again, Ruby's story does mesh perfectly with the known facts, because the facts say that Lieutenant Sam Pierce did drive a squad car out of the Main Street side of the parking garage less than a minute before Oswald was shot. On unedited news video taken in the basement that day, you can see Pierce drive onto the Main Street ramp and disappear from frame exactly 52 seconds before Oswald is shot. Mind you, it is only fair to say here that Officer Roy Vaughan, the young cop who was guarding the entrance to that traffic ramp, swore that there was no way Ruby could have snuck past him that day, even during those crucial seconds when he stepped away from the ramp to make way for Pierce's car. Unfortunately for Vaughan, the evidence suggests that Ruby did take that opportunity to slip past him. Ruby told police this story within half an hour of his arrest, and if his story wasn't true, he had no other conceivable way of knowing that Pierce's car had come out of the parking garage at that exact moment. And for what it's worth, Ruby later repeated this story during a polygraph examination, which he passed. So it seems that Ruby simply must have slipped past Officer Vaughan when his back was turned. Either that, or Officer Vaughan did see Ruby slip past him, but couldn't bring himself to admit later on that he had made such a consequential mistake. Interestingly, Ruby also claimed that when he was halfway down the ramp, he heard a voice yell something like, "Hey, you," but he didn't stop or look around to see who had yelled it. Ruby's story about entering via the Main Street traffic ramp was confirmed from inside the parking garage too. A TV director who was down there at the time, a guy named Jimmy Turner, remembered seeing Ruby walk down the ramp less than a minute before the shooting of Oswald. Turner didn't know Jack Ruby at the time, but the guy he saw coming down the ramp in his distinctive suit and hat was the same guy he saw shoot Oswald only seconds later. Turner estimated that when Ruby arrived at the bottom of the ramp, it was, quote, not more than 15 to 30 seconds before Oswald was shot. There were around 100 people already crowded into the parking garage when Ruby arrived. Around 70 of them were cops, and around 30 were reporters or photographers or other press people. As Jimmy Turner watched him, Ruby moved forward to the area just outside the jail office where everyone was waiting for Oswald to appear. Ruby didn't have to push his way past any cops or reporters to reach this position. He just flat walked up, was how Turner put it. And almost instantly after Ruby arrived in that position, the door of the jail office opened and Oswald was brought out in front of him. As Turner said, quote, "There was only a matter of 4 seconds or 5 seconds when Ruby arrived there until Oswald reached the point where he was assassinated."
It happened in such a blur that it happened. It happened in such a blur that before I knew it, I was down on the ground. The officers had me on the ground.
Had you realized you had done anything?
Well, really, it happened so fast and everything else, I can't recall what had happened from the time I came to the bottom of the ramp until the police officers had me on the ground. have no recollection, no. But I know that they were holding my hand, grappling for the gun.
That's Ruby recounting his rather sketchy memories of murdering Oswald. It happened in such a blur, he says twice. It happened so fast. You can easily see why the shooting must have felt like that to Ruby, because even when you look at it objectively, there's no denying that the whole thing happened in a kind of jumbled rush. Less than a minute before pulling the trigger, Ruby was out in the daylight, not even really sure if Oswald was still in the building. In the next 50 seconds, he slipped past the cops at the top of the ramp, entered the basement, moved through the crowd, and arrived at the spot where everyone else had been patiently waiting for Oswald for more than an hour. And literally 5 seconds after Ruby got there, Oswald appeared right in front of him. And before anyone knew it, including apparently Ruby himself, he'd whipped his weapon out and shot him. Ruby always sounded a bit baffled when trying to describe how he'd felt at that moment. Here's another attempt he made to describe it. Quote, "I had the gun in my right hip pocket, and impulsively, if that is the correct word here, I saw him, and that is all I can say. I didn't care what happened to me. I think I used the words, 'You killed the president, you rat.' The next thing I was down on the floor, I said, 'I am Jack Ruby. You all know me.'" Ruby's language sounds almost unacceptably banal here. Given the historical importance of his crime, you'd like to think that he could have given a more grand account of his motives. Something better than saying that he had acted, quote, "impulsively," if that is the correct word here. Unfortunately, it seems that "impulsively" was exactly the correct word. In the previous episode of this podcast, I tried to argue that to understand Oswald's murder of Kennedy, we need to grasp that the opportunity was a more important factor than the motive and the means. In fact, I argued that the opportunity almost was the motive for Oswald, in the sense that his urge to kill Kennedy didn't really snap into focus until it was announced that Kennedy's motorcade would be coming past the book depository. In Oswald's case, it was 3 days before Kennedy's murder when it became clear that the opportunity was there. In Ruby's case, this process was drastically telescoped. For him, the opportunity really only presented itself 5 seconds before the crime. For Ruby, as for Oswald, the opportunity must have seemed too fantastically good not to be taken. Like Oswald, Ruby already possessed the means in the form of a firearm. In Oswald's case, the firearm had to be retrieved from somebody else's garage, which meant that he had a fair amount of time to contemplate the crime he was thinking of committing, and perhaps even to abandon the idea altogether, as he seemed ready to do on the eve of the assassination when he unsuccessfully tried to persuade Marina to move into an apartment with him the next day. In Ruby's case, the gun was right there in his pocket. Not only was there no time for second thoughts, there wasn't even really any time for first thoughts. If you walk around everywhere with a loaded pistol in your pocket, and if you've got a notoriously short fuse, then your motives for committing murder don't necessarily have to be all that powerful or well thought through. You can murder a man almost on a whim, which I'd say is a pretty good description of what Ruby did. The deep irony of Ruby's story is that if he had mapped out any sort of carefully meditated plan to kill Oswald, if he'd turned up in the parking garage at 10 a.m. when Oswald was supposed to appear, then he almost certainly would have been spotted by the cops and turfed out before he got his shot. One of the many depressing things about Ruby's story is that it suggests it's easier to change history by accident on a kind of half-assed impulse than it is to change it by having a well-considered plan. Ruby's crime shook the world. We're still talking about it now, 60 years after the event, but when you get down to it, what we're talking about is a 5-second brain explosion in the brain of a not particularly intelligent or rational man. Ruby repeatedly denied that he was involved in any sort of conspiracy, but he did more than that. In his more lucid moments, he pointed out that the haphazard way he'd stumbled into killing Oswald effectively proved that there just couldn't have been a conspiracy. If it was a conspiracy, Ruby said, it was the most perfect conspiracy in the history of the world. If it had been 3 seconds later, I would have missed this particular person. I guess God was against me. After his cancer diagnosis, Ruby recorded a final interview on his deathbed, and even on his deathbed he was still cursing the split-second accidents of fate that had turned him into a world-famous murderer. In particular, he found himself thinking back to that illegal turn he'd made into the parking lot.
The ironic part of this is, had I made an illegal turn behind the bus to the parking lot, had I gone the way I was supposed to go, straight down Main Street, I would never have met this fate, because the difference in meeting this fate was 30 seconds, one way or the other.
What Ruby said there was, the ironic part of this is that hadn't I made an illegal turn behind the bus to the parking lot, had I gone the way I was supposed to go, straight down Main Street, I would have never met this fate, because the difference in meeting this fate was 30 seconds one way or the other. Ruby's language is quite instructive here. He talks about God being against him. He talks about meeting his fate, almost as if he was as much a victim of that day's events as Oswald was. These phrases sound odd because from the outside we tend to assume that murdering Oswald was something that Ruby wanted to do. So from his angle you'd think it felt like he got incredibly lucky rather than incredibly unlucky. When he walked into that parking garage and saw Oswald appear in front of him 5 seconds later as if by magic, you'd think that Ruby should have felt like all his Christmases had come at once. But that clearly wasn't the way that he came to see it. He came to see the luck he had that day as bad luck, not good luck. Ruby wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, but on this point I think we should listen to him, because what he's doing is telling us from the inside what it feels like to change history. To Ruby, it felt like being the victim of a series of accidents. From the outside, he looks like a man who made history happen. From his angle, it felt more like history had happened to him. Among other things, Ruby's story is a story about the limits of free will. From the outside, he looks like a man who voluntarily stepped through a series of sliding doors that kept conveniently opening up for him, either by chance or by conspiratorial design. From Ruby's angle, it felt as if he had been pulled through these doors against his will. In retrospect, he came to wish that at least one of those doors had stayed shut. Whether we view the luck Ruby had that day as good luck or bad luck, there's no question that some of his luck that day was truly freakish. Take the incident that happened at the top of the ramp, for example. Officer Vaughan had been standing guard in that position since 9:30 that morning. That is, for almost a full 2 hours. For almost every second of that 2 hour period, Vaughan had been standing on the ramp itself, 2 or 3 feet inside the entrance, so that it was a practical impossibility for any unauthorized person to get past without his seeing them. As Vaughan testified later, there was only one moment in that 2 hour period when he had to leave his position on the ramp, and that was when Sam Pierce's car came up behind him, forcing him to step out onto the sidewalk. And this brief and solitary distraction happened to come at the exact moment when Jack Ruby, by his own very believable account, arrived at the top of the ramp wanting to get in. Then there's the further miracle that Ruby experienced less than 60 seconds later down in the parking garage. The reporters down there had been assembling since 9 a.m, before Ruby was even out of bed. They'd already spent 2.25 hours waiting to catch the moment when Oswald would emerge from the basement door. And Ruby just strolled right up to the velvet rope of history with 5 seconds to spare. Another example of the luck Ruby had that day, whether it was good luck or bad luck, is the fact that he managed to kill Oswald with a single shot to the abdomen. On the face of it, this was quite a low percentage play if Ruby was a hitman trying to silence Oswald forever. The typical hitman move would have been to put a bullet into his head, or preferably two. But as it happened, the single bullet that Ruby fired into Oswald's abdomen took about as lethal a path as a bullet fired into anyone's abdomen could possibly take. A physician who reviewed the medical evidence in the 1970s for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a guy named John Latimer, said of Ruby's bullet, quote, "It's pretty hard to imagine one bullet doing more damage than that. It perforated the chest cavity, went through the diaphragm, spleen, and stomach. It cut off the main intestinal artery and the aorta and the body's main vein, as well as breaking up the right kidney. That wound was definitely fatal." The pioneering conspiracy theorist Mark Lane, who we'll be hearing a lot from in later episodes of this podcast, once said this about Ruby's murder of Oswald. Quote, "Ruby accomplished the murder with a high degree of precision and skill. He walked into the otherwise impenetrable basement, reached Oswald, and fired one shot perfectly placed." This is a typical piece of conspiracist prose. It sounds rational, it sounds like a cool and skeptical summary of the facts, but let's think a bit about the language Lane uses here. Ruby accomplished Oswald's murder with a high degree of precision. His shot was perfectly placed. Lane makes it sound as if Ruby was somehow deliberately aiming at Oswald's diaphragm, spleen, and aorta as he fired his shot, and very skillfully managed to hit all three. In other words, Lane's rational-sounding analysis is actually ridiculous. It's superstitious nonsense. If we're going to think rationally about Ruby's shot, we have to admit that it didn't have to be fatal. The fact that it killed Oswald instead of just wounding him was just another stroke of good or bad luck. There's a name for the fallacy that Mark Lane commits here. It's been called the fallacy of retrospective astonishment. You commit this fallacy when you look backwards at events that happened forwards, and when you forget that because things happened one way, that doesn't mean they couldn't have happened in plenty of other ways. When you look at past events in this wrong-headed way, you're bound to be astonished by all the uncanny bits of fine-tuning that had to happen to make things turn out the way they did. Another pioneering Kennedy conspiracist, a guy named Penn Jones, wrote the following about Kennedy's murder in 1966. "Someday a list must be compiled and fed to a computer to get the odds for such things happening with such perfect timing and placement to produce the assassination." Once again, this is the fallacy of retrospective astonishment. Jones is assuming that all the tiny events that made up the assassination were somehow manipulated or engineered to, quote, produce the assassination story that we've all become so familiar with. He's assuming that this outcome in all its particulars was a kind of target that history was aiming at all along. And when you believe that, then of course you're going to believe that history's aim was improbably precise, and that the target couldn't possibly have been hit by accident, and that some shadowy person or agency must have helped history arrive at its destination. It's exactly the same argument that creationists make when they say that life on Earth couldn't possibly have evolved by the seemingly accidental process of natural selection. Conspiracy theorists like Penn Jones weren't being dishonest or opportunistic when they made this argument. They were just looking at history in a superstitious and fallacious way. Any person's average day would look like a chain of unbelievably perfect coincidences if you were to look back on it in Jones's way. The physicist Richard Feynman had a good joke that exposed the fallacy I'm talking about here. He began one of his public lectures by saying, "The most amazing thing happened to me tonight. I was coming here on the way to this lecture, and I came in through the parking lot, and you won't believe what happened. I saw a car with the license plate ARW357. Can you imagine, of all the millions of license plates in the state, what was the chance that I would see that particular one tonight? Amazing. Conspiracy theorists look at the Kennedy assassination the way Feynman jokingly looked at that license plate. They unconsciously make the assumption that because Kennedy and Oswald died in Dallas, they were always going to die in Dallas. That was the target history was always aiming at. It doesn't occur to conspiracy theorists that Kennedy or Oswald might easily have ended up just getting wounded by the bullets that hit them, or that those bullets might have missed them altogether. That idea is a non-starter in conspiracy theory. Because Kennedy and Oswald died, they were always going to die. They were meant to die, in the sense that some controlling agency wanted them to die and made absolutely sure that they did. This is why the word perfect keeps coming up in conspiratorial literature. Perfect as in too convenient to have happened without the aid of a massive conspiracy. For Mark Lane, Ruby's shot was perfectly placed. For Penn Jones, it was astronomically improbable that all the events that went into the assassination could have happened with, quote, such perfect timing and placement. Sylvia Marr, who was one of the most articulate of the early Kennedy conspiracy theorists, wrote a book about the assassination called Accessories After the Fact, and her chapter about Ruby was entitled The Perfect Timing of Jack Ruby. Marr's implication was obvious. Nobody's timing could be that perfect. As Marr put it, the official account of Kennedy and Oswald's murders, quote, offends those who seek meaning in human affairs and do not conceive of history as governed by random, irrational, and incessant coincidence. Again, this sounds reasonable enough, but there's a word in there that really gives the game away. That word is irrational. Marr declares that history, in her view, is not governed by irrational coincidence. This seems to mean that she thinks history is rational, that it has a mind and intentions. No doubt Marr made an unconscious slip when she accidentally suggested that history was rational, but it was a telling slip because really this is what all conspiracy theory effectively claims. Underneath its rational surface, conspiracy theory has a very religious worldview. The villains in it might be flesh and blood human conspirators rather than gods or demons, but these human conspirators always seem to have strangely godlike powers as well as quite satanic moral standards. They're human beings who have the power to make history come out exactly the way they want it to. Conspiracy theorists hate the idea that history is not under anybody's control. They need to believe that there's a plan or plot behind every big event. They need to believe that somebody very powerful is ultimately in charge of things. Even if that somebody is extremely evil, that still strikes conspiracy theorists as more reassuring than the proposition that nobody is in charge at all, and that an event as historically important as the murder of Kennedy, or even the murder of Oswald, could have been brought about by a lone pipsqueak riding on a wave of lucky accidents. Unfortunately, the evidence suggests that history just doesn't work the way that conspiracy theorists think it does. My late friend Clive James defined history as the story of everything that needn't have been like that. That's what the story of Oswald's murder is like. It's the story of an event that needn't have happened the way it did, and very nearly didn't happen at all. This is the big point that conspiracy theorists always miss. The fact that history happened one way doesn't mean that other outcomes weren't possible. In Ruby's case, other outcomes were not just possible, they were actually far more probable than the one we have. If you rewound the tape of Ruby's Sunday morning and replayed it 100 times, I doubt that he would have succeeded in killing Oswald more than once or twice. If he'd positioned his gun just a fraction of an inch to the left or right, he might have grazed Oswald's vital organs instead of destroying them. If he'd arrived at the scene 6 seconds later than he did, he would have missed his chance altogether and we never would have heard of him. Oswald would have been whisked away in the unmarked car, and Ruby would have gone back home, and nobody would ever have known how close he came to killing Oswald. In fact, the spooky thing to contemplate is that even Ruby himself almost certainly would never have known how close he came to shooting Oswald, since the evidence suggests that his homicidal urges only came to a head at the moment when Oswald appeared in front of him. I'm making these broader points because I'm trying to use this podcast to get to the bottom of what conspiracy theory is and what's wrong with it. Conspiracy theorists in this case do a lot more than just investigate the possibility that a conspiracy might have occurred. If that's all they did, there would be nothing wrong with their project. Real conspiracies do occur, and there's nothing wrong with checking if a conspiracy occurred in any given case, as long as you're prepared to look at the evidence in perspective and accept what it tells you. But that's exactly what conspiracy theorists seem unable to do. They just never seem to get their perspective right. They simplify the complex and complicate the simple. They see big things as small and small things as big. And they make this huge, quasi-religious background assumption that history is designed or meant, that somebody is always behind it. I would never claim to know more about the facts of this case than the conspiracy theorists do. On the contrary, some of them know a lot more facts about it than I do, but they have a chronic tendency to look at those facts inside out or upside down or back to front or whichever way they have to make the facts look sinister. When you look at Jack Ruby's story backwards, starting from the knowledge that Oswald died that day and throwing in the assumption that he therefore had to die that day, then Ruby's story does look like the chain of incessant coincidence that Sylvia Marr complained about. Every single sliding door in Ruby's story appears to have magically opened in just one direction, towards the successful execution of the crime that we're all so familiar with. What were the odds of this happening? It's actually a meaningless question, because when you look at any event backwards, all the doors leading to it will always be open by definition. If just one of those doors had opened a different way, then we'd be looking backward from a different reality, and all the doors would be standing open in that direction instead. One reason that the murders of Kennedy and Oswald and Tippett are worth studying seriously is that they have a good claim to being the most thoroughly documented crimes in human history. Leaving aside the colourful misreadings of the conspiracy theorists, if you're willing to understand how these murders really happened, then you can come away with a pretty good general sense of how history works. One thing that Ruby's story demonstrates is the reality of the butterfly effect. It shows us how the tiniest human move or decision can echo through space and time. If Ruby had decided against making that illegal turn on Main Street, or if just one more random Dallas citizen had decided to go to the Western Union that day at 11:16 a.m., then Oswald wouldn't have been shot, and Jack Ruby never would have been heard of, and I wouldn't be saying the words I'm saying now, and you wouldn't be hearing them. So does all this mean that Jack Ruby definitely wasn't part of any conspiracy? As usual, it's impossible to prove a negative. But what we can do is think about the various ways that a conspiracy involving Ruby might realistically have worked, and we can check how well those conceivable conspiracies line up with the facts on the ground. Those facts effectively rule out the possibility that Ruby was involved in any kind of simple one-agency conspiracy. If Ruby was simply acting on the orders of some agency like the CIA or the Mafia, he would have turned up to shoot Oswald at the advertised transfer time of 10 a.m. The fact that he didn't means that if he was involved in a conspiracy, it had to have been a quite complicated conspiracy, with input from at least one co-conspirator inside the Dallas Police Department who somehow let Ruby know that the 10 a.m. transfer wouldn't be happening. Was it possible, for example, that somebody inside the Dallas PD knew in advance that Oswald would be transferred at exactly 11:21 and told Ruby to turn up at that time? Actually, we can rule that possibility out too, not just because there's absolutely no evidence that Ruby received any unusual communications that morning, but because of the embarrassingly obvious fact that Ruby's behavior that day was not the behavior of a man who was busting a gut to be at the crime scene by 11:21. If Ruby was aiming at that deadline, he wouldn't have been dicking around in the Western Union office at 11:17. In fact, he wouldn't have gone to the Western Union office at all. So that possibility is eliminated as well. Really, there's only one remaining thinkable way that a conspiracy involving Jack Ruby could have worked. Somebody inside the Dallas PD must have deliberately delayed Oswald's transfer until it was clear that Ruby was in place, or was very close to being in place. This sounds like a very roundabout way of running a conspiracy, but it's the last possibility on the table, and nothing I've said so far rules it out. So is there any realistic chance that this happened, or is this possibility ruled out by facts that we haven't yet discussed? We'll be answering that question next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
On the weekend of the assassination, I discussed this with my then brother-in-law, and we talked about Oswald, the alleged assassin, and we said that one had to maintain an open mind on the issue of whether or not he was the assassin and whether or not there was a conspiracy. But that open mind would have to close if during the course of the weekend, Oswald was killed.